From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Crimea applies to join Russia. Israeli-Palestinian peace talks take center stage at the White House. A new website is launched to highlight human rights abuse in Syria.
We just want to make sure that their voices don't get forgotten in the context of everything else that's happening.
A new study finds dramatic new thinning in the Greenland ice sheet. And musicians and fans rock Austin, Texas. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Crimea's regional assembly has declared independence from Ukraine and applied to become part of Russia, a day after a referendum in Crimea overwhelmingly supported joining the Russian Federation. The United States and European Union are expected to announce sanctions today, following Sunday's overwhelming vote in Crimea to secede. President Obama told his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, Sunday that Washington and his European partners are prepared to impose additional costs on Moscow for backing the secession referendum in Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. A White House statement called Sunday's vote illegal and said it violates Ukraine's constitution. It also said the vote will never be recognized by the United States and the international community. Crimea is a primarily ethnic Russian-majority region of Ukraine. Moscow says it has the right to protect its interests in Crimea. In Kiev, Ukraine's interim prime minister, speaking at an emergency cabinet meeting, called the vote a circus spectacle directed at gunpoint by Russia. Dan Pfeiffer, senior advisor to Mr. Obama, was asked by NBC reporter David Gregory on the Sunday Meet the Press program whether Crimea is now lost to Moscow.
We are putting as much pressure on the Russians as we can to do the right thing. We have given them the opportunity and the path to de-escalate and get this in the right place because they know that there are costs to their action here. The costs are economic. The Russian economy, the Russian stock market, and the ruble are at five-year lows. Russia is isolated in the world. You saw that in the UN Security Council yesterday. And the more they escalate, the longer this goes, the greater those costs will be.
So if Crimea votes to become part of Russia, there's still a concern that there might be an attempt to move into eastern Ukraine, maybe even militarily move in to Crimea further. Do you think that's going to happen, starting with Crimea?
Well, first, as it relates to the referendum, as we've said, this referendum is in violation of international law. The United States is not going to recognize the results of that referendum. And we are working with our partners around the world, the Europeans in particular, to marshal forces against the Russians to put pressure on them in the form of sanctions. And the president has signed an executive order last week that gives him the authority to do this. And you can expect sanction designations in the coming days.
If there is a move militarily into the rest of the Ukraine, how important is it from the president's point of view to arm Ukraine, to send military aid to Ukraine to be able to protect itself?
Supporting the new Ukrainian government in every way possible is the top of our priority list. We're looking at all ways of assistance, and we're going to keep talking to the Ukrainians.
But would the president call on Congress to pass more military aid for Ukraine?
We are calling on them right now to pass economic aid for Ukraine. There's a bill that came out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee just last week. They should do that, and we're going to keep working this as much as we can.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Sunday agreed to push for Ukrainian constitutional reforms for power sharing and decentralization as a solution to the crisis. European analyst Leslie Templeman-Holmes of the University of Melbourne told VOA's Victor Beatty he views the Crimean referendum as a farce.
The numbers suggest that there were Russians bust into Crimea or taken over to Crimea to vote. The Crimean authorities could claim that this was in part because the Kiev-based authorities, the new Ukrainian government, had not given them the electoral list. But the fact that the last figure I saw was getting on for 80% turnout and more than 90% support for joining Russia, the figures just don't add up. Another problem with the whole referendum, although we're all calling it a referendum, it's actually a plebiscite because it's not binding on any government, even the Russian government. There was no opportunity for voters to say they wanted the status quo. They wanted Crimea to stay in Ukraine more or less along the lines that it's been in for the last, well, since Ukraine was independent at the beginning of the 1990s. All they were asked was whether they want to join Russia or, in essence, to become an independent state along the lines of a constitution that existed in Crimea for about 13 days in 1992. That plus all the intimidation from Russian soldiers, although the Russian authorities will tend to deny that they're Russian soldiers, this makes the whole experience one that cannot be legitimized internationally.
What happens now, sir? Is there a concern Russia will engage in a full-fledged invasion of eastern Ukraine?
There is a concern that that could happen. I'd like to think it's unlikely. Putin's already made his point, which is that Russia has to be taken seriously again. Unfortunately, there were some in the West who were overly triumphalist in the early 1990s with the breakup of the USSR and the collapse of communism. And that really hurt people like Putin. So there's a combination of that. And also, he himself has been increasingly, apparently, reading up on Russian philosophers of the 19th century. And I can see a lot of his approach being similar to that of actually Tsar Nicholas I, whose ideology was orthodoxy, autocracy, and national identity. Putin has been getting closer and closer to the Russian Orthodox Church. He is an autocrat. And this latest expedition into Ukraine is an example of him saying that Russians must all be together, whether they're in Russia or on Russia's borders.
Jonathan Adelman, associate professor of the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies, says the West has very little leverage with the Kremlin.
We could have restrictions, for example, on their oligarchs and the money that they spend in the West, but Russia is sitting on over $400 billion reserve fund that they have built up in oil and gas, so they could pretty easily offset that. The Russians have a much greater concern about Ukraine than we do. It's right next door. It used to be part of the Soviet Union. It still has 8 million Russians there. So the problem is to really keep up the pressure on Putin is going to take a great deal of work, even more so because the European Union is talking, but they've got 12% unemployment. They've got 0.1% growth rate, and they've got Italy, and they've got Spain, and Portugal, and Romania, and Bulgaria. They really don't want to get too deeply involved in this because they have so much problems on their own soil. So I think, while it's important what the president said, I think the reality is it's going to be very difficult to really move forward on this, or even with support in the United States Congress, which is modest.
What impact, if any, will this have on the May 25 Ukrainian presidential election?
I think it's going to push Ukrainian nationalists, to turn out in large numbers. And even in eastern Ukraine, there will be a large number of Ukrainians and even some Russians who are deeply troubled by all this. Let's remember that although Russia and Ukraine have had long battles, that Ukraine also, eastern Ukraine, was under Russian dominance for the overwhelmingly from the 1650s all the way down to, 1991. So given all of that, I think many of the people, even who like Russia, they don't want to have a tense situation. They don't have a military one. And overall, their biggest issue is very simple. It's not politics. It's economics. The average doctor is making $295 a month. They have $3,850 GNP per capita compared to 50,000 United States. The result is they actually make less than Albania per capita. So given that, the number one issue, just like in the Arab Spring, is not just politics. It's really the horrible life that the average person leads in this country. And who can do better?
How are the former Soviet republics and Eastern Europe looking at what's happened in Crimea?
They're worried. They are certainly not pleased. They don't want to be next for pressure because in some of the Baltics, for example, there is a large Russian presence. But in none of them are they actually a majority. But I think this reminds them of the frailty of their position, being so close to Russia, so far away, at least 4,000 miles from the United States. And I think it's going to lead them to want to become closer to NATO and closer to the EU, where they're already, significantly integrated, because they need to counterbalance Russia. It's weaker than it used to be. It's no more 400 million people with their empire, and the Soviet Union, it's 130 million. But they're right across the border. They're very nearby. They know it, and that's what the problem is.
Ukraine's acting defense minister told reporters that both Ukraine and Russia have agreed on a truce in Crimea until March 21st. Sunday's vote came a day after Russian forces seized a natural gas facility just outside Crimean territory. The Ukrainian foreign ministry called the move a military invasion by Russia. Troubled Israeli-Palestinian peace talks take center stage today at the White House. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas will meet President Barack Obama with a deadline looming at the end of April for a framework peace agreement. The proposed framework would cover the thorniest issues of the conflict: the status of Jerusalem, Palestinian refugees, Jewish settlements, security, and the final borders of a Palestinian state. The United States is pressing both sides to compromise, but expectations are low and gaps are wide. Palestinian spokesman Ahmed Assaf says his side will accept nothing less than a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders with East Jerusalem as its capital. Israel says the 67 lines are indefensible, and it has vowed not to compromise on Jerusalem, saying the entire city is its eternal capital. Another stumbling block is Israel's demand to be recognized as a Jewish state. Mr. Abbas has refused, saying that would harm the rights of Israeli Arabs, as well as the right of return of Palestinian refugees to their former homes in Israel. So after more than 7 months of U.S.-mediated peace talks, there is growing pessimism and acrimony. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon said the Palestinian president is not a partner for a final peace agreement that would end the conflict, adding that Mr. Abbas is a partner who wants to take but does not want to give. President Obama met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House 2 weeks ago and urged him to make hard decisions for peace. And he will have the same message for Mr. Abbas. The United States hopes a framework deal will prevent the collapse of the peace process and enable negotiations on a final agreement to continue until the end of the year. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
A group of international human rights organizations has launched a new website to focus attention on activists targeted in Syria. Amnesty International, the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Network, the International Federation for Human Rights, Frontline Defenders, Human Rights Watch, and Reporters Without Borders want to highlight the plight of abused human rights defenders, the media, and humanitarian workers. We spoke about www.freesyrianvoices.org with Amnesty's Claudia Schlüssler.
The purpose is just to highlight the plight of civil society activists, media workers, and medical workers who've been arbitrarily detained or abducted by Syrian government forces or armed opposition groups in Syria purely for doing their work and exercising their human rights.
And you're talking about peaceful people, not people who are out on the streets causing trouble.
No. We're talking about peaceful activists who are literally detained solely because they were exercising their human rights to freedom of expression, their human rights to freedom of association, or people who've been solely detained because they were doing humanitarian work or they were doing medical treatments, for example.
Will you help people who may have been abused by the Syrian rebels and the Syrian government, both sides?
Well, the website is for people that are currently detained to highlight their plights. But yes, it's cases from both the armed opposition groups and from the Syrian authorities.
Now, how does this work?
At the moment, we only have 37 cases who we consider emblematic of a large number of others. And basically, the organizations submit different cases, and then they will be featured on the website according to certain criteria. So at the moment, we focus on lawyers and human rights defenders, journalists and media workers, medical workers, and political activists.
So you tell these people's stories?
Yes, basically, because we think it's important to highlight that not only is there a war going on and there's the humanitarian crisis, that's of course very important, but at the same time, there are these activists and their voices are being lost, and they're such an important part of civil society and of Syrian society in general. And they remain in enforced disappearance in some cases. In some cases, they've been detained for years. The family hasn't had contact with them. So we just want to make sure that their voices don't get forgotten in the context of everything else that's happening.
Could you share with us one of their stories?
Yeah, of course. For example, there's Syrian human rights lawyer Khalil Matouk. He was actually detained on the 2nd of October 2012 when he left his home, and he never arrived where he was meant to be, and his family never got any official confirmation of what happened to him. And the only reason they know anything is because unofficial information basically told them that he's likely to be detained in a political security detention facility in Damascus. But they've been asking the authorities, and they just don't get any answers. And it's incredibly difficult for them. And we think that he's solely detained because of his human rights work, because as a lawyer, he's been defending political prisoners for a long time, and he's publicly denounced the practices depriving his clients of their right to fair trial.
What are you hoping the reaction of visitors will be to your website?
We would like visitors to sign up to our Thunder Club, which is basically meant to raise awareness. So the Thunder Club will go live on the 17th of April and will post a message that will basically be our demand, which is to free activists, media and humanitarian workers who are detained solely because of their work or their peaceful activism. And we hope that this will just increase the pressure on the Syrian authorities and on the international community to follow up and, you know, follow their obligation under international law to release these people who are detained arbitrarily solely because of their work. And as you may be aware, there was also the UN Security Council resolution recently, which also called for the release of all persons detained arbitrarily. So we just want to really make sure that there's pressure.
Claudia Schussler, campaigner for the Syrian team at Amnesty International, speaking with us from London about the new website, www.freesyrianvoices.org. The UN Refugee Agency reports that more and more refugees from the troubled Central African Republic are arriving in Cameroon in desperate condition, with many of them sick and dying. UNHCR spokesperson Fatoumata Lejeune Kaba says the new arrivals from the CAR tell aid workers they were forced to hide in the bush for long periods of time in fear of being killed by militiamen who were targeting Muslims in revenge attacks. She says the refugees say they had no choice but to flee for their lives, despite the hardships they have encountered on the way to Cameroon.
Many have lost relatives to hunger along the way or shortly after reaching Cameroon. They are also very much traumatized by the horrors they experienced in northwestern CAR. As an example, we have one refugee who said that he could no longer eat meat because he had seen someone being killed and cut into pieces by the anti-Balaka. A woman has lost six of her nine children in the bushes after 7 weeks. And this is a woman whose husband was also killed by the anti-Balaka.
Lejeune Kaba tells VOA it is not unusual to have refugees arriving in a country of asylum, exhausted, sick, and hungry. But she says the extremely dire condition of the CAR refugees upon arrival is not normal.
We do have cases in refugee situations where people travel long distances and come exhausted for sure. We've seen it with the Sudanese who were fleeing from the Blue Nile, for example, coming into South Sudan. But we didn't systematically hear about losing family members along the way we are hearing from the CAR refugees now.
The UNHCR reports more than 44,000 refugees from the CAR have fled to Cameroon since March 2013. That is when Muslim Seleka forces seized the capital, Bangui, and ousted the government. A warmer climate at the poles has accelerated the loss of ice mass and raised concerns about sea level rise and other impacts on the weather. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel reports, a new study finds dramatic new thinning in the Greenland ice sheet in a region considered stable until now.
Last July, Kirk Kerr was collecting sample sediment cores from a lake bed in southeastern Greenland when his science team witnessed a dramatic event.
We landed and suddenly you could feel that the ground was starting to shake.
The research director of the Natural History Museum of Denmark at the University of Copenhagen is co-author of the new study about the Greenland ice sheet.
And, you know, we turned around, you know, and we could see, oh, there's a calving event. Two huge icebergs that are 700 meters deep that are coming out of the, that has been released from the glacier and that is turning around. And you know, you can actually pick up the signal, you know, from seismic station due to these shaking of the earth all the way down to Japan.
Ice sheets like those in Greenland and Antarctica are constantly in motion. Calving at the ocean's edge is part of that natural cycle as the ice mass flows downhill under its own weight, moving through ice streams, glaciers, and ice shelves. The sheet remains stable as long as it accumulates the same mass of snow that it loses at sea. For their study, published online in the journal Nature Climate Change, the scientists collected surface elevation from the entire ice sheet using satellite data. While they knew that the south, east, and northwest were already losing mass at accelerated rates, Kerr says they hadn't expected to see sustained loss in northeastern Greenland, which was considered stable.
So it's a new area that has started to react to a warmer climate, and it's warming in the sense that it's a warmer summer temperatures and warmer ocean temperatures.
Reduced sea ice, where the glacier meets the warmer ocean, allows icebergs to break off from the edge of the shelf. That causes the ice stream to accelerate toward the sea. The northeastern ice stream drains almost 16% of Greenland. Kerr says their findings will affect the models of future sea level rise.
Of course, it's a concern. And there you can say that if you have an area in Greenland, like the northeastern sector, that has been considered stable, but not contributing to any significant sea level rise, it's somewhat of a bigger surprise, you could say.
He adds that scientists will look back at the history of the ice sheet to put more recent observation in perspective.
But my feeling is that we will see that the mass loss that we have seen over the last 10 years is something that is out of the ordinary.
Kerr says the new data will improve predictions of changes in a warmer world. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Austin, Texas is known as the live music capital of the world, and that reputation is enhanced each year during the South by Southwest Festival. The event, which started in 1987, has grown larger each year, and this year offered more than 2,000 showcase performances at venues all over the city. Greg Flakus has details from...
Unlike the Wolf of Sixth Street, most musicians come here looking for exposure. If they can't get it inside a venue, they'll go out on the street.
There's always music being played here on Sixth Street in Austin with all of its clubs and bars, but during South by Southwest, there's even more of it, and it comes from all over the world.
There are bands here from all over America and from as far away as Japan, South Korea, and Azerbaijan. And thousands of fans pour into Austin to hear them play. Joywave, an indie rock band from Rochester, New York, played at a venue sponsored by Spotify, an online streaming music service favored by young music fans. Bass player John Donnelly and singer Daniel Armbruster are confident that their band will stand out.
There's none like ours. It's also not a competition. I think Spotify, like, all music is instantly accessible forever, so everyone can listen to as much music as they want to.
But many musicians are clearly here hoping for a big break. It's summed up in a song by New York-based comedic songwriter Jessica Delfino. Among the local singer-songwriters who already has a well-established fan base is Eliza Gilkison.
Oh, Eliza, you try so hard, you don't see nothing.
Her new CD, released during the South by Southwest Festival, displays a style of self-expression that's become a model for many younger female singers.
Strip something down to you and a guitar, there's going to be something timeless about that, that is, it's the same through the ages.
Growing up in Los Angeles, Gilkison's first musical impressions came from her songwriting father, Terry Gilkison, who penned many hits and also sang in a folk group.
His music was around me all the time, and he loved, you know, sort of dark melodies, and he really was a master song constructor.
I listen for the whistle, and I lie awake and wait. Wish the railroad didn't run so near.
On her new CD, she included one of his songs.
The clatter of the old fast freight is always ringing music in my ears.
Eliza Gilkison keeps playing concerts and selling CDs with her masterful performance of songs that appeal to both the heart and the intellect. Greg Flakus, VOA News, Austin, Texas.
They want more, they want more. And their hunger will never depart. But wherever I roam, far from you and our home, I've got you.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 17th, 45 BC, Julius Caesar defeated Republican forces in the Battle of Munda in modern-day Spain. The victory led to his dictatorial rule of the Roman Empire, but that didn't last long. Caesar was murdered the following year on March 15th. March 17th is celebrated as St. Patrick's Day, a national and religious holiday in the Irish Republic in honor of the country's patron saint. It is thought to be the date on which he died in or about 460 AD. In 1901, paintings by the Dutch master Vincent van Gogh were shown at a major Paris art gallery. The 71 paintings caused a sensation in the art world, bringing acclaim to the artist who had died a decade earlier. In 1905, on this date, future President Franklin Delano Roosevelt married his fifth cousin once removed, Eleanor Roosevelt, in New York. In 1921, there was a revolt by Russian sailors in Kronstadt, a naval station on the Gulf of Finland that served as the base for the Russian Baltic Fleet. Thousands were killed in the unsuccessful uprising against the Bolsheviks. On March 17, 1941, the National Gallery of Art was dedicated in Washington, D.C. In 1959, the 14th Dalai Lama fled Tibet for India. He remained the leader of Tibetan exiles until his retirement on March 14, 2011. On this day in 1969, Golda Meir became the fourth Prime Minister of Israel. Born in Kiev, she grew up in the United States before immigrating in 1921 to Palestine, administered at that time by the British. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On March 8th, many countries celebrated International Women's Day, honoring women and their achievements. Some countries, including the United States, have also set aside an entire month to celebrate women's history. On these occasions, we recognize the importance of women's empowerment and progress toward gender equality around the world. We also take time to recognize the many challenges that still remain. Women everywhere remain the backbone of their families, working daily inside and outside the home to keep their families afloat and their communities cohesive and thriving. Yet too many women's efforts remain outside the formal economy. Evidence has shown that when women entrepreneurs are empowered to join the public marketplace, they can make valuable contributions not just to their families, but to their communities and nations. This also holds true when women become involved in public decision-making processes, including conflict resolution. Yet women are too often underrepresented or even prevented from participating in efforts to rebuild post-conflict societies. Countries that value and empower women to participate fully in decision-making are more stable, prosperous, and secure. The opposite is also true. When women are excluded from negotiations, the peace that follows is more tenuous. Trust is eroded, and human rights and accountability are often ignored, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry in a recent article marking International Women's Day. The inclusion of women in peace building and conflict prevention can reverse that trend, wrote Secretary Kerry. Peace is not the absence of conflict. It is the presence of every member of society working together to promote stability and prosperity. No country can succeed unless every citizen is empowered to contribute to its future. And no peace can endure if women are not afforded a central role. So today and this Women's History Month, let us mark the miles women have traveled around the world. But more importantly, let us commit to the next miles of the journey.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.